Dr. Meyer, you wrote some time ago that the American government had succeeded in eliminating serious malnutrition throughout the United States. Is that still your opinion?
No, it isn't. The survey that was done in 78-79 by the same physicians and scientists who had done the survey in 68-69 had found that, in effect, hunger and malnutrition due to poverty had disappeared, and that clearly the food programs were responsible, because it had happened even in places where there'd been no economic improvement. At present, with the steady hacking away at the food programs, we are seeing hunger reappear in the United States, and I'm very worried that some of the conquests of the 70s are going to be lost.
From CBS News, Washington, Face the Nation on the CBS Radio Network. A spontaneous and unrehearsed news interview with Dr. Jean Meyer, a nutrition specialist who is now the president of Tufts University. Dr. Meyer will be questioned by CBS News medical reporter Dr. Holly Atkinson, by Marion Burroughs, food columnist for the New York Times, and by the moderator, CBS News correspondent George Herman. But first, here is George Herman.
Jean Meyer was born in Paris, France, on the 19th of February, 1920, the son of a physiologist or student of cell and body function. Nevertheless, at the University of Paris, he took his degree in literature, graduating with highest distinction. Then he acquired a Bachelor of Sciences degree, receiving numerous high scholastic honors in the process. He served with the French Army in World War II, and after the French were defeated, he served with the Free French Forces of General de Gaulle, winning the Croix de Guerre with two palms. When the war was over, Meyer took his doctor's degree at Yale University, studying chemistry, and then another at the Sorbonne, studying physiology. Then he began teaching nutrition and public health at Harvard University. He has published 750 or more scientific papers and a number of books on diet and health, mostly on the regulation of food intake and the development of obesity. Meyer has been much sought after as an expert consultant, working with the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations and with the World Health Organization and with UNICEF, and he headed the UN's Task Force on Child Nutrition. At home, he has served as the chairman of the National Council on Hunger and Nutrition in Washington, and in 1969, President Nixon made him chairman of the first White House Conference on Food, Nutrition, and Health. Meyer is a fellow of the French Academy of Sciences and of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and since 1976, he has served as president of Tufts University. In addition, this busy man serves on the boards of several large American corporations and on the World Affairs Council. Through it all, he's been known as one of the world's great experts on human food needs and foibles, a man widely considered to be a cool, neutral observer in the best scientific tradition, not given to fads or to dogmatic views. In fact, Meyer's wide-ranging interests have taken him into a number of areas not usually associated with nutrition, giving him an unusually broad view of his own field in the process.
And now we continue with Face the Nation.
Dr. Meyer, you referred to the cutting back of federal food programs. Let me ask you, is there clear evidence already that some parts, some places, some people in the United States, as a result, are beginning to suffer from severe malnutrition?
Yes. Some of my colleagues in Boston, in particular at the Children's Hospital, see clearly signs of malnutrition reappearing, which they hadn't seen for quite a while. And simple economic calculations shows that there is a growing number of people who cannot literally afford what nutritionists consider to be a minimum diet. So I think there is a danger that the one social problem that we had eliminated may be coming back.
Dr. Meyer, the administration has proposed transferring the responsibility of the food stamp programs to the states, and you have called that a serious mistake. Why?
There's several reasons for it. First of all, let's face it, the federal government has been consistently the best friend the poor, the sick, and the students have had. The states have had a very much more checkered record. Secondly, when you have states which, like Michigan, are having a terrible time with a very high unemployment, they are the least capable at this point of taking over a program, the expenditure for which goes up when the economy is bad and down when the economy is good. There is a need for a sort of insurance effect, which only the United States as a whole can provide, but which individual states can't provide.
Dr. Meyer, there is some indication that the infant mortality rate, which has been decreasing for the last decade, is now going up once again, specifically in two large cities in Michigan where there's a high unemployment rate, and in the state of Alabama, up so significantly that in Saginaw, the rate is from 17.5 deaths per 1,000 births to 24. Is that related in any way to poor nutrition, or does it have more to do with stress and other things?
It's probably a complex matter, but infant mortality is much more clearly linked at this point to social phenomena than it is to medical care as such. And its height really parallels the degree of poverty of an area. It's low in rich areas, it's high in poor areas, almost irrespective of the amount of medical care available.
Are you making a distinction between medical care and nutritional care or not?
Yes, I am. Medical care may be available, but if the nutrition is poor, medical care will be, to a certain extent, unavailing.
Well, let me take you back to this growth, resurgence, if you like, of malnutrition. What are the expectable social, and I might say budgetary and financial costs to the nation of this?
This is clearly a case of being penny wise and pound foolish. All the evidence we have shows that the WIC program, the program for pregnant and nursing women and infants and children, clearly leads to a decrease in the number of premature births. And premature births, more babies, are in turn very much more likely to have both body and intellectual problems.
And require very
expensive. And require, if they are mentally retarded, lifetime care. The care of a retarded person in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts on a lifetime basis at this point is of the order of $2 to $3 million. And it can be immediately proved that the expenditures for each dollar spent on a WIC program saves at least $3 or $4 in terms of medical care later.
But that has to do with infants and small children. Other people on food stamps, for instance, are the elderly and the disabled, and they're talking about cutting food stamps perhaps once again by another $1 billion. Is that going to have an impact that you're going to be able to see? Is anyone going to be able to prove, the way you were talking about proving what happens with infants, that this really does make a difference?
It's easier to prove the effect on infants. It's easier to show the effect on the growth of children. But one can demonstrate it in the aged as well. For instance, there's a great deal of anemia among the elderly, men and women.
Anemia.
In the United States, anemia.
Anemia.
And there is, of course, also a great deal more likelihood of admissions to nursing home, of appearance of premature senility, which may be linked in some cases to malnutrition rather than to the degeneration of a central nervous system as such. Again, I think that of all the foolish ways in which to save money, not to feed people, particularly at a time when we have surpluses coming out of our ears nationally, seems to be one of the most short-sighted.
Dr. Meyer, the government has also announced plans to rescind the prohibition against allowing junk food to be sold in schools next to the food that the schools are offering. What do you think that'll do to the children's nutrition?
We have no nutrition policy at this point in the United States. We tried to set one up in the White House Conference on Food, Nutrition, and Health in 69. It worked for a while. At this point, I see the Department of Agriculture in particular as being in full retreat. The guidelines which were promulgated, the dietary guidelines, which were very important in terms of advice to avoid cardiovascular disease, to avoid certain forms of cancer,
to avoid malnutrition in general, have been ignored. Junk food is now again permitted under the WIC program, some of the sugared cereals, some of the least desirable foods. It's quite clear that at this point the resistance of this administration to the economic pressures is almost non-existent.
Is junk food necessarily poor nutrition?
Yes. I think that at a time when our population really is very mobile, and where therefore the caloric intake of people has to be quite moderate, otherwise they get fat, it's important to have every calorie count.
That maybe you could tell us what junk food is. I think people really don't have any idea what
is
that means.
Is it the same as fast food, or what is junk food?
No, not at all, not necessarily. By junk food, I mean foods which really do not carry their weight in terms of the calories in the food, not being accompanied by enough protein, essential fatty acids, minerals, and vitamins.
Example?
Example, sugar as such. Example, foods containing very large amounts of fat, very large amounts of sugar. There is the additional problems that that large amounts of sugar are bad for your teeth, particularly in areas which are not fluoridated. That large amounts of fat, particularly saturated fat, are bad for your cholesterol level. That the high-fat foods are usually also very high-salt foods. And in spite of everything that's been said, the correlation between a high salt intake and the chances of getting hypertension continues to be very well established. So that poor attention to nutrition clearly increases the health bill of the nation.
Is giving food stamps adequate? Should a nutrition policy say that food stamps should be spent, for example, on high calcium foods for the elderly so to avoid osteoporosis, on special foods for children to meet their needs, or should we just let every poor family decide for itself what to buy with those stamps?
I think there are limits to the extent that the government can tell everybody what to do, what to eat, and so on.
But can suggest.
Suggesting is an entirely different thing. I think the problems of nutrition education are universal. Nutrition education is needed for the rich as well as for the poor. So my view is that food stamps should continue to be given. There should be only mild amounts of restriction. They should go to foods. And that nutrition education ought to be directed at the whole population.
I made an assumption in that question, which you may not perhaps agree with, and that is that calcium in the diet is an important factor for elderly women, especially suffering or threatened with osteoporosis. Is it?
A continued good supply of calcium is important throughout life. We have at Tufts, as you know, the first nutrition research center entirely devoted to nutrition and aging. And osteoporosis is one of the subjects they are studying. Once people have osteoporosis, a high intake of calcium alone doesn't seem to be adequate to reverse it. But certainly maintenance of an adequate supply of calcium throughout life is very important as a preventative.
You mentioned your nutrition center at Tufts. I wonder if you find that there's any difficulty in speaking out as forcefully as you might against the government's nutrition policies when you have to take so much government funding for your nutrition center.
I think in their heart, our friends at the Department of Agriculture know that I'm right. And I don't think there'll be any reprisals against my speaking quite frankly, although I know that they are constantly under pressure from the Bureau of the Budget to reduce the food programs, from many of the primary manufacturers, the egg, the meat, the dairy people, not to speak up on the problem of fat and cholesterol. They won't do it, but I don't think they'll prevent me from doing it.
Well, you also know that the president has said that the reports of increasing malnutrition are, quote, greatly exaggerated, unquote.
Well, I'm sure there are many things that the president knows that I don't know, but nutrition doesn't happen to be one of those subjects.
You mentioned in passing and sort of dismissed with the side of your hand the question of salt and high blood pressure. What is a prudent person to make of these studies showing that cutting the salt of people who are healthy does not seem to affect their blood pressure and their hypertension one way or another? That there is some of your colleagues have said they can see no scientific data saying that the average healthy population should consider salt as a factor at all.
You know, for a very long time, we had the same type of debate on the relationship of cigarette smoking and cancer of the lungs. Most people who smoke do not develop cancer of the lungs. Most people who stop smoking are not affected from that viewpoint one way or another. The evidence that there is a clear correlation between the salt intake of populations and the prevalence of hypertension is undeniable. It's been shown throughout the world. Populations with very low salt intakes have very low rates of hypertension. Populations like some of the Japanese islands with very high salt intakes and by and large very good states of health otherwise have very high rates of hypertension. There have been studies done by one of my colleagues at Tufts on differences in rates of hypertension between islanders in the Pacific who use a lot of salt in cooking and some that don't use salt in cooking and are otherwise very identical populations. And again, there are big differences.
Well, let me put it in a more specific way. Going back to the average healthy population, if a person has reasonably normal or normal blood pressure, should he or she worry about salt, or can such a person forget about salt?
No, I don't think that person should forget about salt. I think it's a good idea not to get used to a high intake of salt, and to a very large extent, it is a matter of being habituated to it. If you cut down on your salt intake within a matter of about 3 to 5 weeks, you get used to a new level, and the food doesn't taste less salty, and your chances of developing hypertension are less.
But Dr. Meyer, this year it's salt, last year it was fat and cholesterol, the year before it was fiber. People go crazy. I mean, what kind of advice can you give to people across the board on how they ought to maintain their diets?
Well, the advice remains the same. You should have a varied diet, you should have a lot of fruits and vegetables, whole grain cereals if you like it. You should try not to have too much sugar. The average American eats something of the order of 125 pounds of sugar per person per year, which is absolutely preposterous. You should cut down on fat, particularly on saturated fat. Try not to have more than something of the order of 30% of your calories derived from fat. And you should cut down on salt. Alcohol clearly is a big social problem. The evidence that the Framingham Heart Study and other studies showed is that having the equivalent of one or perhaps two drinks a day is not harmful. Now, a drink a day might even be beneficial. More than two is certainly bad, and the problem of drunken driving is a terrible problem, and as a university president, it is one of my constant worries.
Dr. Meyer, what you just gave as a prescription for health sounds like the United States Dietary Guidelines. How can there be so much controversy about whether or not these guidelines are good not only to prevent cardiovascular disease, but as it turns out in more recent study, perhaps even cancer. Is there not a consensus about this?
I think there is a reasonable consensus on this. There's certainly a consensus that the dietary guidelines represent a diet which cannot do you any harm and probably can do you a lot of good. You have to remember that there are enormous economic interests involved. And you also have to remember that there are people who make a lot of money out of prescribing all sorts of bizarre diets, which keep on popping up, burning with a brief flame and disappearing and then being replaced by another one. I think that unless you recognize that the advice that's given to the American people is not always disinterested. You can be baffled by the diversity of advice.
How do you determine who's giving you disinterested advice?
That's a very good question, and it's a question that I hoped was resolved by the dietary guidelines which were promulgated by the government. The government has, in effect, ignored them recently. A new committee has been appointed, the composition of which I have grave doubts about. Only one of the members, Dr. Levy, as a matter of fact, my colleague at Tufts, the Vice President for Health Sciences, he's a cardiologist. He's the only cardiologist on the panel. Some of the members of the panel are very close to some of the special interests I mentioned before. It is a problem. By and large, I think that people ought to ask their pediatrician in terms of nutrition of their children, and I think pediatricians know a great deal more nutrition than they did 20 years ago. Cardiologists have become much more sophisticated as regards nutrition as they used to be.
Cancer specialists?
Cancer specialists, of course, have a more difficult time. The tie between nutrition and cancer is less clear, although there is mounting evidence that a high-fat diet predisposes to cancer of the colon, the large intestine, and cancer of the breasts. So that the same general advice which is good for cardiovascular disease is probably good for the avoidance of two of the most common forms of cancer.
You mentioned just a few moments ago the Framingham study, and one of the things that came out of that study was a suggestion that perhaps low cholesterol levels were causing some cancers, particularly in men, digestive system. And that's almost in direct conflict with what you just said about high fat causing cancer. Is that cleared up at all?
No, I think that's that was a statistical suggestion, but I don't think there is much support for it. In general, you must remember that not everything is going badly. In the past 12 years, since the White House conference, in general, there has been a clear decrease in mortality from cardiovascular disease throughout the country. It's difficult to analyze specifically what this is due to, but certainly one of the factors is better control of hypertension. Other factors may well be nutritional. People are more careful about salt. There is a slight but significant decrease in the cholesterol level average of the nation in general. There's certainly been an increase in exercise, a decrease in cigarette smoking, at least by men. The one thing which hasn't changed very much is weight control. People still have the same type of problems that they had 10, 15 years ago.
Are we not seeing more fat people, or is that just anecdotal evidence that I am seeing more fat people? It seems to me we're seeing considerably more obesity, real obesity, than we used to see.
Well, I think this is true if you take a very long period. I don't think it's necessarily true if you compare it compare the prevalence now to 10 years ago. But the striking thing that has happened to the American people is a drastic decrease in physical exercise. People eat less than they ate in 1900 or throughout the 19th century, but they exercise extraordinarily less. And from that viewpoint, clearly the single most important factor in the development of obesity in the United States is the automobile.
You know, the obesity issue raises a point about starch blockers. Before starch blockers were taken off the market, people were consuming them at a rate of 1 million pills a day.
Mm-hmm.
What does that say to you about the way people understand nutrition and their desire to have weight loss immediate?
I think what it says to me is that the average American thinks that if something is sold in drugstores in particular and makes medical claims, somebody has checked it. And I think this is a very good argument for reinforcing the Food and Drug Administration, because it comes as a great shock to people, as happened with starch blockers, when studies are published which shows that it's like the emperor's new clothes, the thing isn't working at all. People assume that if it is advertised and has to do with health, it had been tested and it had been verified.
If that goes one part for starch blockers, it must go 1,000 points for vitamin pills.
It should go for vitamin pills. There is absolutely no excuse for allowing on the market this multiplicity of mega vitamins with claims that are clearly unproven and in some cases dangerous preparations.
How about just the ordinary, we'll take one pill a day, vitamin supplement to help people who don't have time or energy or whatever to eat properly?
I have no objection to it as an insurance, as long as people take the recommended dietary allowance and not 1,000 times the dose which is recommended.
Well, if we are going to have all of these pills available, do you think that advertising claims should be regulated some way so that they can't say all of these things about starch blockers?
I certainly do. And yet again, in the past 2 years, the trend has been exactly to the opposite. And every restriction on that type of claim has been eliminated.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jean Meyer, for being our guest today on Face the Nation.